You're listening to Hooked on Startups, where every week you'll hear from some of the most talented, inspiring, and successful entrepreneurs who share their real-life stories, how they overcame challenges and failures, and how they mastered success. Get ready for some of the best business tips, tricks and tactics, and some frank, unscripted discussions. Here's your host, Matthew Sullivan.
Welcome to Hooked on Startups.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
I'm delighted. I'm excited to have you on because you are an author. I mean, you're many, many things. We're going to get into all of that. But it is, you know, how would you describe yourself?
That's a good question. It kind of depends on the day of the week.
and who's asking.
And who's asking. Sometimes I'm a husband, a grandfather, a friend, a golfer, an author. Just a guy, you know, kind of depends. Lots of different things.
Does that depend on how well the round is going? So if someone says, how are you doing? Today, I'm not a golfer. I'm the husband today.
Right. Today, I'm anything but.
And how many times have you thrown your 5-iron into the lake?
You know, I'm not a club thrower. That I don't do. I've done just about everything else wrong on a golf course, but I'm not a club thrower.
I think the biggest mistake I ever made was buying a very good set of clubs.
Yeah, well, you ran out of excuses.
Immediately. So that's the thing, you know, and you go around, you're pulling these tailor-made clubs.
Yeah.
Then you realize all it does is just highlights how absolutely awful I am at the game.
It's a very difficult game. And if you don't play it, it's impossible to appreciate truly how hard the game is. But it's also very satisfying. I get a lot of joy out of it. And I have learned to enjoy the game without playing well. Now, if I play really terribly, that's no fun. But I don't have to play well to enjoy the game anymore. So that's been an improvement for a long time.
And I think it's funny, actually, because I think there's a definite correlation between entrepreneurialism and the way that you play golf. This is my theory. Okay. This is based on a sample of one, which is me. So I really enjoy trying to hit the covers off balls at the driving range, see if I can hit a ball 400 yards or something, which I've never done and never will do. But when it comes to the short game, it's like, oh God, I haven't got time for this. You know, where's the fun? Does that sort of encapsulate, do you think, some of the ways that entrepreneurs think?
Yeah, no. I mean, swinging as hard as you can bring tremendous reward, but it carries risk with it, and it doesn't always work out, but it works out just enough to make you want to do it again. Another way I've heard people talk about it is the difference between whether or not you're a debt guy or an equity guy.
Determines how you play. Yeah.
How you play, right. If you're a risk taker, if you're going for it, you're an early stage equity guy. And if you're a debt guy and you're happy with a low rate of return, but first in position, then you're a debt guy and you play more conservatively.
Yeah, so. It's funny. I mean, yeah, so I think that's absolutely true. I'd never thought of it that way. It's funny because your career, I think latterly and even now in terms of your previous career before, you know, you became the main screenwriter for what is destined to be, you know, the next great motion picture, I'm sure. Yeah. When I was reading, you know, Blood in the World, when I was reading through the summary of Blood in Low Country, the immediate thing that sprang out was, I can see a movie here. I can see, but we'll come on.
Yeah. No, I can too. I can yes. too. Yeah.
And that's the funny thing, but your career in finance, and I think you started off as an attorney, is that right? And then moved.
That's correct. I was a lawyer for a whopping 2 years.
And then what cured you of that?
Having to be a lawyer cured me of it.
Yes.
The first 6 months was exciting. My first job, earning my keep. I'm a lawyer. Second 6 months, it very quickly became a job. And the last 6 months, it became something, how can I get out of this before they start paying me too much money and they have their hooks in me?
Yes.
So I think the handwriting was on the wall for me pretty early on when one of my clients said, I want you to do this, 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 and this to this guy. And I said something like, well, they're just going to do it right back to you. And I realized that it just wasn't cut out for me. I was in the bankruptcy department and we represented primarily lenders.
Yes.
We did some debtor work and it was a great education. But as a career, I just couldn't see myself doing it for the rest of my life. It would have just eaten me alive.
That was some time ago. And that was in Phoenix. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. That was from 1988 through into 1990.
Yeah, and those were the, you know, the prime times of you know, Gordon Gekko and, you know, Greed Is Good, and
yeah, we had the SNL crisis was yes. in full bloom when I moved out there, and so these savings and loans, these a lot of cowboys who were able to assimilate a lot of money, and they found themselves with money to lend.
Yes,
and a lot of real estate backed deals, lots of fees, lots of high interest rates. And a lot of it, if I remember correctly, this is going back a long yes. way, was fueled by the tax code, which allowed for accelerated depreciation of assets, which ensured that you could make money but not have to pay taxes because you had all these non-cash expenses yes. that put you into a non-taxable position. And then the tax code was rewritten, don't ask me when, 86, 87, somewhere in there. And the accelerated depreciation was taken away. And so you had deals that, frankly, were being fueled by a desire to avoid taxes as opposed to whether or not it would truly cash flow.
Yes.
And so they all of a sudden they just went upside down and kabam, next thing you know, you've got all these single asset LLCs going under.
Yes.
And when they went under, they pulled down all the SNLs with them.
Yes. I mean, it's fascinating just to see how these structures are set up. But and was it at that point, I mean, because making the move, and I'm sorry to sort of, you know, throw the ball back such a long way, but probably seems like yesterday to you.
Yeah.
But moving from that, I mean, I think your career moved into something much more entrepreneurial. It would be so easy just to stay in that same lane, as it were.
It would have been. But I had a desire to create and build. And most likely got that from growing up with my father, who was an entrepreneur. First in his family to go to college. He was a civil engineer graduate from Georgia Tech, and he was a manufacturer's rep. And then, you know, early on in his career, he decided, well, I can make a better product than I'm selling. And he went into business, you know, making products, commercial construction, and he did quite well. So I'm miserable. I know I can't do this any longer. And so sometime in, you know, 89, 90, around there, I got it in my head to buy a business. And back then there was no internet. So you would go through the Sunday classified ads, yes. businesses for sale.
We had Dalton's Weekly in England.
And right. And so you get these businesses for sale. And I found one, no money down. All I had to do was take over the debt, which should have been a sign to me that this was probably not a good business. But I sent the financials to my father, and because he had bought a smaller company along the way to kind of build up his. And I asked him for his help looking at the financials, and he goes, what's going on? And I go, Dad, I'm miserable. I cannot be an attorney for the rest of my life. And he's like, well, I paid for law school. You owe me. You got to come work for me. And so I said, all right, what is it exactly that you do, Dad? And so that began about a 5-year process where I went to work for my dad.
Yes.
He manufactured building materials for commercial construction, primarily owner-occupied businesses, a lot of hospitals, government buildings, prisons, et cetera. And I learned that, did that for five and a half years. That was a great experience.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, particularly because your father probably was a very hard taskmaster, like all.
He was.
Yeah. You know, you probably got away with nothing.
Yeah.
But you learned everything because you were, you know, because you were the trusted person. And so that
I learned a lot. Yeah, I did learn a lot. And I joked that my dad, I'd go, hey, Dad, what about, or have you thought of, or I'd say some idea, and I'd get one of these from him, which said everything.
Yes.
And so it was good working for him, also a challenge to work for a parent.
Yes. And you can always say, look, if I've got this wrong, it's your fault.
It's right. Exactly.
Because you never, you know, it's
you
funny,
didn't teach
actually,
me.
When you say that you didn't know what your dad did, I think my wife is convinced that my job is to print business cards.
Yeah.
You know, with different names on and different things. But I notice on your website, you say that being on, you know, entrepreneurial is a word that is misused, and you know, people say, I'm an entrepreneur, when in fact, it's, you know, what it actually means is that you are unable to hold down a job.
Yeah.
So you're sort of congenitally unemployable. So I think that there's an argument that entrepreneurialism is some form of disease that is passed down from generation to generation, rendering you incapable of working for someone else.
I think there's some truth to that. And I had my most recent experience was So after I worked for my dad, I started several businesses along the way. And in 2015, our youngest son had gone off to college. And so my wife was anxious for me to slow down. And I had wrapped up a business with a business partner. The wrap up had gone very well. He wanted to continue in the business. I was ready to move on. And I was 10 years older than him. So he was at a point in his life where it made sense for him to continue. So I moved on. We had a nice separation of what was his and what was mine. And I was tired. I was exhausted. I just wasn't up for another startup.
Yeah.
So I became a consultant.
Yes.
Consultant, quasi executive for hire.
Yes.
And so I ended up working for a couple of other smaller businesses. And I found it a challenge when they wouldn't do what I told them to do.
Yeah.
And there was one that was a difficult place to be. And I'm not saying I was right and they were wrong. It could have been just as easy the way around.
It's almost like being an investor.
It's difficult to just share your opinion and that, or be told that's all well and good, but we need you to do this.
So you're back to sort of square one. I mean, I think consultancy is a really, really difficult thing to do for that very reason, because you have all these things that you see, and the longer you spend with people and the deeper you get involved with their business, the more you can see opportunities that perhaps, but that's tempered by the fact that you no longer have the ability to impose your point of view on other people.
It's not my business. It's not my business. So it is.
Years though, I think, didn't you? You suffered at the.
So I did. I started and sold, I think, three different businesses. And each one becomes all consuming. And I think it's very rare that you'll find someone that can birth a business and then take it all the way through its growth cycle.
Yes.
Now, there are people that have done it and that do it well. I think it depends. Like if you were to start a business in an established industry, I'll just make one up. Let's just say you decide to become an HVAC contractor, mechanical engineer.
Yeah.
You're not reinventing anything. I'm not saying it's not hard. You have to go out and find customers, but you understand the business. But if you are starting a business with a new product or a new service in a new industry where everything you're creating, you constantly have to create the customer and the opportunity and the market. And then you get to that, to be able to then take that to the next stage is very difficult because your mindset is one of starting and creating. And it might just be, you could say, you get bored, you get attracted by the next shiny object. And so it can be difficult to shepherd a startup all the way through, the various stages in a company's life. And I think that probably describes me.
I think that's absolutely right. But I think also what you said at the beginning is the most important thing. It depends on the person, because there are some people, again, going back to our golf analogy, where you've got the initial thrill of, hitting the ball and making contact. I don't know why I'm using golf, because I might as well use baseball or football or something. I mean, I know an equal amount. How many times can you divide zero? But I think also that there are opportunities where in a startup where you see success and that sort of fuels you along. I mean, which is exactly the position that you're in now, really, because you are embarking on a career that potentially has enormous rewards, but is about as challenging as it can get, because you are surrounded by a sea of illogicalness. There you are. I've just invented a word. You can use that if you like. Illogicalness. Your sequel, a new character, Mr. Illogicalness.
Mr. Logical. No, it is. When I started down this path to become an author, I started down the path by writing a book. And it wasn't necessarily my goal to become an author. My goal was to write a book. And I did that, and it's been well received, and I loved doing it. So I'm now writing my second book, and I'm selling my first book. And frankly, in a lot of respects, my career hasn't changed one bit in that I'm an entrepreneur. I am a self-published author, and the product that I'm selling is me. And that's a very difficult thing to do, because in the past, my product had been XYZ. I was in the seismic engineering business for a while. I was vibration control for semiconductor and life sciences for a while. Then I was a real estate lender for a while. I've done a lot of different
I can see the natural synergy with a self-published author now.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden, the business side of being a self-published author is, I find it to be very challenging, extremely hard. It is an uphill battle at every step of the way. And this is one of those, I've entered into a field where I didn't know what I didn't know, and I continue to learn. And I'm better positioned now to understand the task ahead of me. But to be a self-published author and have any expectation of succeeding in terms of sales, it's unbelievably difficult.
Yes. But is this something that you had inside you for years? And you swore that at one point you would write the book.
I would say no. I was not the guy that got up and went to work and kept thinking, I want to quit all this and go write my book. That wasn't me. I've always enjoyed reading, and I've often thought, could I write a book? You know, could I do this? Could I do that? And I had reached the end of a consulting project and was, you know, sort of, you know, had a little downtime and, you know, looking for the next project. And so I, you know, oftentimes I'd finish a book and I go, that was a phenomenal. Finish a book and I go, good. I think I could have done that. And so my wife, tired, said, why don't you either try it or move on? So I said, all right, I'm going to try it. I had a couple of months, you know, I had nothing lined up. And so I sat down to try to write a book. And so I read a lot of books on writing a book, read a lot of blogs, had, you know, 4 or 5 legal pads full of notes and ideas. And I got started on it. And then a friend of mine called me up and said, Paul, there's this company. I think that you guys would get along well. So I ended up taking a consulting project that lasted for 18 months. Yeah. And I didn't get that much writing done. It wasn't a very productive writing time. I kind of moved paper around my desk a lot.
I can imagine waste paper baskets full to the brim with sort of screwed up pages.
Yeah, pages, words, ideas that were half-assed, half, you know, sort of worked. And I finished that consulting project, and I had, like, you know, 2 other opportunities waiting. And so I'm talking to these people and they weren't going anywhere. Oh, it's so-and-so needs to make the decision. And, you know, he's super busy with this project, whatever. So I finally decided that if I was going to give this writing a chance, I had to go all in. I had to go all in because I know that if I take a consulting project and it's supposed to be 15, 20 hours a week, it ends up being 40. And so I just said, but nope, I'm going to give this a shot. So I spent the next 6 months doing nothing but writing the book and then learning how to do the cover design and learning how to get it published and then learning how to sell the book. And as it turns out, I enjoy it so much that I now, you know, I'm all in now. This is what I do. I'm a writer and I'm writing book 2 and I'm blogging more. And all of this is to build up this brand so that people will see, oh, Attaway wrote another book, and they'll, you know, that they buy it sight unseen. So this is the challenge.
But do you, and also, so there's 2 things. The challenge is huge, but I think the payoff is probably greater than anything else because of the fact that you've overcome that challenge. Is that something that you would agree with?
Yes. I mean, the potential, when you're talking about payoff, you mean the financial rewards?
No, not the financial rewards, just the emotional payoff, the sort of psychological payoff of, you know, you're opening yourself up to all sorts of criticism.
Yeah. Absolutely. No, when you have it, it's just me, you know, this is it. And so you put that book out there and you hope that it's funny because I had a lot of friends who they were almost afraid to read the book because they're like, well, Paul, what if it's just horrible? What am I going to say? You know, I've known you for so long. And so apparently the book wasn't horrible, you know.
Did you send it to people saying, here's my book, please don't read it?
Yeah. No, I had a couple of my wife and my kids all read it. And my kids are young adults now. And I had my older brother read it. I had 1 or 2 close friends read early drafts. And they all said, Paul, this is good. This is good. So then I finished it and I turned it over to an editor. And then the editor came back and said, this is really very good. And so that gave me some comfort that I at least had a few, and had the one editor, while paid to do the job, didn't know me from Adam and could speak probably more honestly. It's difficult for my wife to provide objective.
Did she leave notes
assessment.
For you on the refrigerator? Like, I've been meaning to say, but page 50, you know.
Yeah, no, she's a good critic, but she's been very encouraging along the way. But I did, I finally, so then it's out there. It became available last September on Amazon. And I sent out an email, you know, to everybody I'd ever met, you know, hundreds of emails, get the webpage built, Instagram, and had a couple of book signing parties early on with people that I know. And it was unbelievably rewarding.
Yeah.
All the fears that I had were vanished because my friends that I've known for a long time, they couldn't have been happier for me. You know, they were very encouraging.
Would you say that one of the biggest challenges is learning to get out of your own way when you're writing a book? In other words, overcoming these fears of, you know, potential criticism or, you know, not knowing what to do next or not knowing what to write next.
Yep. It is the literal and figurative blank sheet that you're staring at. Not knowing how to write a book, not knowing even how to start, not knowing what to do next. And then those fears of, you know, rejection, those fears of failure, those fears that either A, you're not going to be able to do it, or B, you'll finish it, but it just won't be any good. And all your friends then will know. And so, yeah, overcoming those fears and dealing with them and moving beyond them was a big part of the challenge.
But you enter, once you go beyond the veil, as it were, you enter a new world where you realize actually there's probably a lot more depth to your imagination than you gave yourself credit for. And, you know, I just noticed this with very casual, light bit of research that, you know, some of the characters of your book, Monty in particular, are now creating their own persona outside of the book. How is that happening? So what do you see in terms of the byproduct?
Well, the byproduct would be sequels.
Yes.
More books using the same characters, but not necessarily a single protagonist. I mean, you know, I love the author Daniel Silva, and he has a great character, Gabriel Alon. And I love this recurring character, and I, you know, read all of his books, but they're always him. So what I'm trying to do is create a world based here in Charleston, South Carolina, with more than one recurring character. And so one book may focus on this character, one book may focus on this character, and giving real depth to these characters. Because I think books, I enjoy a good plot-driven book, but I enjoy books that are character-driven more than I do pure plot-driven, where you see the characters change, they come under pressure, they may do things that you're shocked by, they go through what's called a character arc. And so I am trying to, you know, build off of a handful of these characters, their own world, so that when people come and read this series of books, they know what they're going to get. And I think once you are able to do that, then it becomes easier to, you know, to sell the next book and the next book, because they go, oh, I like these books, or I like the setting that these books take place in.
But does it become harder, though, to continue to provide depth to the characters without potentially drawing? You have to sort of separate Monty from Paul.
Yeah.
Is there a challenge that the lines may be a little blurred where you're, how do you find the life? How do you draw?
Yeah.
What do you draw on to create that character?
You know, it's the creative process. I can only describe it for me. I can't describe it for anybody else. And it is, it requires a tremendous amount of trust that it's going to happen. And I mean, in the business world, if I were given a task, I could look at this task and I go, okay, that letter is going to take me 10 minutes to write this offering memorandum. I need to give an executive summary, give me an hour and I can knock it out. And you just sort of, you know, you kind of knew what to do. You know, but the creative process, you don't know how long it's going to take, whether you're trying to solve an engineering problem, whether or not you're trying to develop packaging and you only got $2.50 a unit to spend. You have to do research. You have to, I think, immerse yourself in a subject matter. And then the ideas, they pop into your head. They all of a sudden you go, oh, I have an idea. And whatever it is we do, when you go, oh, I have an idea, it appears. And sometimes you could be listening to music or going for a run or reading something that gives you an idea about something else. So I can't explain where ideas come from, but I do know that when I sit down and I free myself of distractions and I just start typing, and I just start writing, that it happens. And I start, and all of a sudden I start, well, this could work. And you start writing. And, you know, I might write, you know, a couple of thousand words in a day. They'll get re-edited. Some of them may get thrown away, but typically there's the genesis of something and I go, okay, I can work with that. So it's not something I can just turn on and off. Others might be able to. I have to sit down and trust that it's going to happen.
And it's, again, do you find that this is something that you never expected would happen? And there are so many parallels with this and yeah, all sorts of other things in life, you know, in terms of not yeah, just entrepreneurial well, life. But,
you know, I was in high school, I was on the debate team and in college. And every teacher I'd had since sixth grade said, you should be a lawyer, because I talked, I was a smart ass, you know, pretty good at school. And so that was where I was headed. And so then I went to law school. And then after a year and a half, I'm done. So I would say basically everything I've done since then, if you had asked me when I was younger, would I be living in Charleston and writing books? I'd go, no, I don't know. So no, I did not see this. But then again, I think that's what makes life interesting, is to be open to risk-taking and things you never could have imagined or would have imagined.
I think also when you were talking about trust in yourself, I mean, I can imagine or remember or think of so many occasions where you have no idea how you're going to do the next thing, whether it's yep, the next step in your business or how, you know, you're going to get something to work that needs to work, whether it's a financial structure or a piece of software.
Yeah.
That ability to have faith in yourself that don't worry, you know, you'll be all right. I mean, where does that come from? How do you generate that? How do you create that? How do you find that in yourself?
Well, I'll say a couple of things about that. I think success breeds success in terms of I've faced challenging times before and things worked out. I think that definitely success will breed success. You won't be quite so scared, for lack of a better word, the second or third time around. But I think the other thing that helps is failure. When you realize that the things that you feared weren't worth fearing, so that when you experience disappointments and when things don't work out the way they're supposed to, and all the horrible things that you thought were going to happen, either A, didn't happen, or B, ended up not being so horrible, that gives you the confidence to take chances. I think living in fear is one of the things that handicaps us. So a lot of the trust that I have really is just, I try not to live in fear of anything. Now, I don't leap out of airplanes without a parachute. I mean, I'm not stupid.
Yeah.
But, you know, the things that keep us from taking risks, from taking chances, are fear of rejection, fear of not being accepted, fear of not being loved, fear of failure, you know, things like that. And we make them out to be so much more than they are. And so I've had those failures and disappointments. And when I got through them, I realized that it wasn't as bad as I expected. And frankly, something really cool came out of it. Yeah. And, you know, I have a very supportive and loving wife. And a couple of the challenges that I had in the business world brought us closer together. So that's a good thing.
Yes.
I think fear is a terrible thing.
Yeah, I think someone said that fear is just a temporary lack of information.
Temporary lack of information or way too much misinformation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Believing lies, believing things that aren't true.
And also, it's a product of a fertile imagination. It's actually the worst thing you can have.
Yeah. You can have, if you have a fertile imagination, you can imagine the worst. You can imagine all these things. But
that must have been one of the biggest challenges you know, you probably didn't go into this for the money.
No, I didn't.
As you said, you didn't go into it because you always wanted to be a lifelong author. So, you know, taking the leap, as it were, the biggest challenge for you must have been that fear that your friends, your family, you know, look at you in a different light because you would be Paul the
really bad writer.
The guy who, you know, for God's sake, you can read his book, but not for the reasons that he'd like you to.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. No, I'd say that was that was definitely it. I would, knowing what I know about being a writer, I would not advise anyone to become a writer if their goal is to make money. Now, you can make huge sums of money, but you'd probably have a greater chance of simply becoming a doctor. and making a lot of money than writing a bestseller and having somebody pick up the movie rights. There are so many books published. It is so hard to get noticed. It's a lottery, really.
But the secret weapon here is your 30 years plus of experience as an entrepreneur dealing with these different businesses.
So it helps.
Part of you now saying, okay, first book's under the belt. I've got some really good ideas for the sequel. Now, let's roll up our sleeves. Let's see what we can do with this industry. Are you now excited about this whole new landscape that's in front of you with these?
It is.
Is that another?
Yeah. Now, it is a business challenge. And the challenge is getting published is not that big of a challenge. Getting published simply means getting your book in print or in digital format. So you can do that. It's then getting it sold. And if independent bookstores will never know you exist because they're called on by publishers. And publishers don't carry your book unless either A, an agent has brought it to them, or B, you manage to somehow get their attention. And so if you are self-published, the only way you can get into independent bookstores is, frankly, by going door to door.
Yeah.
And which is what I'm doing here in the Southeast. I go door to door and I have a book signing this Wednesday at about an hour from here, a place called Polly's Island. And they're happy to carry a local author about a book, you know, who has a book based here. But the other 15, 20,000 independent bookstores out there in the country don't know who I am. So then you're dependent upon Amazon and Barnes and Noble, the Kindle and the Nook and all the formats. Well, there are some 10. See, being able to be self-published is a wonderful thing because you can get published, but it also means there are no gatekeepers. So I like to think my book is pretty good, but I also know that there's absolutely nothing stopping anybody from publishing a really bad book. Yeah. And there are about 10,000.
Case in point.
Well, there's about 10,000 books published today in this country. So getting noticed on Amazon means it's social media. It's Facebook ads. It's Google pay-per-click ads. It's Instagram. It's Twitter. It's social media. And creating a brand and a following so that you have followers. So I knew this much about social media, you know, a year ago. Yes. And now I'm on Facebook and Instagram daily. I'm not on Twitter, remains to be seen, but it works. It's fairly affordable, really time consuming. It's hard to be genuine and effective and original at it every day.
And right. I mean, yes.
Yeah. You have to do
audiences.
It constantly. You have to be, you can't turn it on at all, turn it on. You have to always be out there.
I mean, impressing the internet is always a rather challenging task.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Impressing the internet's difficult. Mm-hmm. Right.
But do you think that publishing is one of the last industries that is still done with a handshake and personalities because of the nature of what the business is, the fact that it's authors creating works? It's a bit like an artist and a gallery.
I think there is some of that. And I think also that the publishers go back before Amazon, before the internet, you know, they had a stranglehold on the business. And you had to get an agent who would then take you and help you find the publisher. But once you were in, you were gold.
Yes.
And there weren't nearly as many new titles every year. They could spend a lot of time and money pushing and promoting their authors. And you'd walk into your Barnes and Noble or your all the other bookstores that you might go to, and the books would be there and you could find them. So now with the agent, now with the publishing world, you still have the big five or so, but the margins they make on each title have come down. The publishers expect the authors to do more and more of their own advertising with social media. And so they've become even more selective because they don't have the horsepower to go and promote. I mean, but it's like once you're in the club and your book is going to get published and printed and pushed and promoted regardless. And so breaking into that, it's difficult. And so an agent, they're going to come along and they're going to go, do you have more than one book in you? And who is your audience? And do you have an audience? And if I was promoting nonfiction, they would say, well, Paul, how many followers do you have? Well, I'm not nonfiction. I'm fiction. So I'm having to build it. So my goal, my hope is that I sell enough books as a self-published author just through sheer persistence and muscle that when I finish my manuscript for book two, that an agent will take a harder look at me because they go, okay, you did this on your own. You've got more than one book in you. I'll take a look at you.
And how much of that success impacts your ability to write? So does it become a vicious cycle? In other words, where if you don't get the success and the wins that you're hoping for, does that take the wind out of your sails when you're trying to write the next chapter?
I think it would, and it will, and it might. I say all three of those.
Hedging your bets. That's right.
Hedging my bets.
Check here. Yeah.
I mean, if, you know, ideally, if you were picked up by one of the big, you know, Simon & Schuster or someone like that, they're doing a lot of the heavy lifting. They're managing the distribution. They are going to get you in front of book clubs. They're going to get you in the bookstores. So that's one less thing for me to worry about. Frees up the time. As with anything else, if your revenues exceed your expenses, you can kind of relax a little bit and you're not making rash decisions. You know, I'm in a situation where I can spend a little bit ahead of the curve to generate revenue. But at the same time, if this becomes a financially losing proposition, while I may continue to write, I'll write with different goals in mind. I'll write and I won't spend as much time marketing the book. So, I mean, you can't be stupid with money and go spend $1 million.
It's like the challenge that every artist has where you want to be pure to your, you know, to what drives you and what you want to see, both as the written word or, you know, as paint on a canvas. Right. But there comes a point where you got to eat, I suppose. But
yeah, one of the first time this reality hit me was I was fortunate enough to meet a consultant online and struck up a conversation with her, and she knew her way around the industry. So she helped me through this learning process. And so she starts asking me, well, Paul, what's your genre and who's your audience? And all these questions that I look back on, they made perfect sense. But when I sat down to write a book, I wasn't thinking about marketing. I wasn't thinking about, you know, the demographic of my reader and what their average income is and all these types of things. I was writing a book. So I wrote this book and I go, well, I don't know. I finished the book. I guess we're going to find out. So now I do think a little bit more about, okay, what bookshelf would this be on at Barnes & Noble?
Is that a good thing though?
I think within reason, you don't want to just write garbage that's just going to appeal to people that read a certain. Maybe you do. James Patterson's done pretty well. Formulaic approach. He's very talented too. I think that if your goal is to get published, then you need to take a realistic look at this. Other than self-publishing, if your goal is to be published by somebody else, they're in it to make money.
Yes.
And so they're going to go, well, these books, they don't sell. It doesn't matter if you're Hemingway.
Yes.
You could be a beautiful writer. No one wants to read stories about X.
Yes.
If you want to write them, that's great. But yes, if you're going to hope to get published by someone else, you need to understand that if your book has larger appeal than smaller appeal, you're going to have a better chance of getting picked up.
But again, it's like business. You're solving, in, you know, successful businesses solve problems. They don't just, you know, you have the adage, right, if you build it, they will come. You know, it doesn't work. No. Are you seeing the same sort of thing? So is your business brain thinking, hang on a second, you know, even though my emotional side is slightly offended by the fact that I'm going to have to, you know, tweak slightly the way that I write these books. Is the logical side of you thinking, this is actually a bit like a business where, you know, the problem people have is that they want to read stuff that they like.
Right.
If I don't solve that problem, I'm not going to sell anything. And I want to sell books because
there's some satisfaction to it. Right.
That's the next step, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I think, and this may have to do more with the fact that I was not a trained writer. I was not an English major. I took classes. I was a finance major in college, and then I went to law school. So I had no training in storytelling. I learned to write in law school. So I've always thought that I was a good writer, but storytelling is different. And so one of the things that I'm learning that I believe addresses this market challenge is it's fiction. People read fiction to escape.
Yes.
Yes, they may learn something along the way about if it's historical fiction or about a certain something or other that you can squeeze into the book, but it's fiction. So they want to escape. And, you know, there's popular advice to writers, write what you know. Well, that's great and all, But if you write about your own life, it's pretty damn boring, frankly. You have to fictionalize this stuff. Yeah. So I think one of the ways that you can appeal to the market, solve this problem, meet the need, is to provide them with an escape from what they do. They want to go and sit someplace, whether it's for 10 minutes or an hour, and they want to go find out what's happening to Monty, what's happening to so-and-so. So I think part of the challenge is when you're writing, you have to let go of the fact that this probably wouldn't really happen in the real world.
Yes.
Now, you can't be so overblown that the story makes no sense. I mean, so you have to achieve a balance between believability and yet escapism. And I think that is something
that's the skill, isn't it?
That's a skill. There's a definite skill to it.
And you can draw, sorry to interrupt, but that is where you draw on your decades of experience in dealing with people. And
if you read my book, Blood in the Low Country, there's a subplot that involves some shady real estate developers and some shady lenders. And a lot of my buddies that are in the real estate business, they go, okay, Attaway, who was that character based on? I go, I'm never going to tell. You know, so I do draw on some, not personal experiences, but experience being a real estate lender for a while.
I can imagine. Were you the author of the disclaimer at the front of the book?
Yes, I was.
Went on for 40 pages.
Yes, purely coincidental.
It sounds like it's the beginning of an incredible journey. Probably, I mean, do you think this is far more rewarding and challenging and exciting than you ever thought it would be?
Definitely yes to both of those than I ever thought it would be. I know if it wasn't, I wouldn't be doing it again. Writing a book is hard. Now, there are others out there that make it look very easy, and quite possibly for them it is easy because they're extraordinarily gifted and talented. And so that's not to take away anything from someone from whom it comes easy. But, you know, it's hard. But so it requires focus. And there are lots of things to distract us more and more with every new technological time-saving device. And so to put those distractions aside and to set aside time every day, not every day, but try to every day to write requires discipline and focus. And those can be a challenge.
Well, I'm excited. I'm excited because, you know, A, there's a very good chance I can probably get a signed book.
Yes, sure is.
No. Which I will pay for, of course. But to have been able to have this conversation and know that Paul Attaway, who I once spoke to, who is now the screenwriter of the latest blockbuster, because I've really said, as I said at the beginning, you can see this. It's not just the stories and the depth and the characters, but it's you driving it.
It would be fun.
You can see that as you get to each stage, you know, your enthusiasm and, you know, you'll be rolling up your sleeves saying, right, come on. We can make this happen.
So So I am. My wife jokes that she hopes George Clooney has a role in the movie.
That's right. Better hurry up. Salt and pepper becomes
before he gets too old.
But that's pretty. Anyway, now we shall depart momentarily to our Hooked on Startups quick fire question.
Very good.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Fasten your safety belts. Scream if you want to go fast. So, question number one. What is your favorite word?
Well, it's a word you've never heard of. The word is a squeebelitch.
Now, I'm going to ask you to say that one more time slowly.
Right. It's called a squeebelitch. And we challenged our kids when they were very young to come up with their own word that would describe virtually anything. They could say if they didn't feel like going to school that day, they felt a bit of squeebelitch. And so basically, this is a word our children created to use to describe anything at any point, a squeebelitch.
It sounds like a fantastic character that should be alongside, you know, Wallace and Gromit and the squeebelitch.
Right. A squeebelitch, yes. It could be a noun as well, right?
And so it's fantastic. Great. Right. What is your least favorite word?
Social distancing. Two words, but I'll call them
tautological. I'm not sure if it's tautological.
It should be asocial distancing.
Yes.
It should be asocial distancing.
Yeah. It's funny. Words that we never thought would be put together in that context.
Yeah.
Question number three. What are you most excited about right now?
My wife and I, kids are all gone. Everything's paid for. We have purchased a home in McCall, Idaho, and we're moving out there next week, and we'll be spending our summers out there.
Fantastic.
So a break from the heat, Phoenix heat. And now we live in Charleston. We love Charleston, but summers can be brutal. So
yeah,
that's
I remember I spent some time in Charleston. It gets a little humid.
It gets a little sticky. So this is what's got us most excited right now.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Question number four, what turns you off right now?
Politics.
You know, you're not the first person to say that. Question number five, what sound or noise do you love?
Our grandson laughing. He's about 8.5 months old,
yes.
And he's learned to laugh, and it's just great.
I know that sound very well. And question number six, what sound or noise do you hate?
It's the sound of chairs being dragged across floors, fingers on chalkboard, just that horrible pitched squeak noise. Can't take it.
Or the sound of some politicians, effectively.
That would be the same thing. Right. Synonymous, yeah.
Question number seven, what profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
Sports broadcaster. I think.
What sport? Racing?
Like a football game, baseball, basketball game, being the broadcaster, doing the play-by-play of the college
painting
football.
A picture with words for those of you listening in AM radio.
Right. Exactly.
Drive to work.
I think that's one of those things that. The people that are really good at it, they make it look so easy. But I think to be a really good play-by-play announcer, that there's a lot of work that goes into it. I think that'd be
you're building this sort of this two-dimensional. You're bringing color over the radio, so
right? Exactly.
And what profession would you not like to attempt?
Politician.
I can see there's a bit of a theme here. Actually. Yes. So your
Absolutely.
Next book. I mean, is there a book where the politicians get it? There's some sort of, you know.
There's got to be. I mean, if you're
book
looking
number three.
For, yeah, if you're looking for a bad guy, you know, there's, you know, in our politically correct world, you can still, Nazis can always be your bad guy. You know, Nazis are never going to have a fan club out there. So you can always make Nazis your bad guy. And I think today you could make politicians.
You've got a dodgy dealing real estate politician, something like
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. Right. Yeah. Politicians are a safe mark in our politically correct world. You can still.
And there are volumes you can write.
They are.
So our final question then, if heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Paul, I'm so glad to see you.
That's fantastic. Well, I can't begin to say how much fun this has been. I'm so excited to follow your progress.
Well, thank you.
It's been such a pleasure. And what is the best way for people to get hold of you and find out about these?
The easiest place to go would be the website, and it's just paulattaway.com. And from there, there's a contact page. If someone wanted to email me, there's you can find out how to buy the book. There are links to Barnes & Noble and Amazon and a few others. And then my Instagram page is at author Paul Attaway.
Fantastic. How absolutely exciting. I mean,
it is. Yeah.
It is.
My kids can't believe it either, because I was, you know, that was, they thought I'd be the last guy who would ever be on Instagram and Facebook.
I know.
And so, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so, ha-ha to them.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you once again, Paul. And look forward
to staying
in touch.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Bye.